With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
My name is David Preece, former goalkeeper, now goalkeeping coach at Östersunds FK in Sweden.
So I was talking to our friend Luke Moore a while back, and I was saying that in a far lesser way, that when I was a kid and I was growing up on my estate, I never imagined where work would take me. And I think if like 10 or 12 year old me got a window into my life, and now as an adult, I just couldn't compute it. It would just blow his mind, like where I'd been and what I'd done. So for you, having achieved the dream of becoming a professional footballer, and now in what, having played in four different countries, and now coaching in a fifth, what would 10 or 12 year old David have thought?
He'd probably be disappointed, I think, simply because it,
really,
yeah, I think so. Just because from a very young age, I always had a, I don't know, it's just a feeling or a desire to play in the top European league.
Right. You know, really?
Yeah. Well, just because I fell in love with, first fell in love with like the Danish and French national teams of the 86 World
Cup. Yeah.
So the 86 World Cup was my first real World Cup where I took real notice of it.
The same.
And yeah, so it was, you know, I always talk about the World Cup video that came after that, Hero, the one that was narrated by Michael Caine.
Yeah, yeah.
And the music was by Rick Wakeman, I think it was. And so it, that's where like my love of European football came from. And then after that, then obviously because of Serie A, there was you know, the Germans and the Dutch were going to Serie A. So I, for birthdays, my father would buy me like the compilation, the goal compilation,
110 great goals Italia style.
Yeah, like that.
Yeah,
The one, there was ones for like for each season.
Yeah,
you can find them on YouTube now. I've went back and watched them a lot of times, like, you know, and loads of names, random names stick in my head, like Ramon Diaz and people like that.
Yeah.
It was
Pietro Paolo Verdes.
Do you know what I fell in love with these videos as much as I did with the game.
Yeah.
And then so from then on, it was kind of like, or like Platini, I sort of took great interest in Platini, and then for some reason sort of a big interest in Zanetti. I thought, oh, I'd love to go and play in France. And then that was that for me, that was the dream, really. And then I got to 29, and I'd had a chance to go to Belgium when I was really young,
right?
And that didn't quite come off, but then I got to 29, got a chance to go to Denmark, and then really enjoyed it, and I wish I'd done it years before, and I wish I'd kind of been more proactive in trying to push a move abroad, really.
So what was it? Do you think you were just in your comfort zone, or you felt you still had stuff to do in the British game, or maybe you just needed to be a little braver? What do you think it was?
It was probably the same thing that hindered me most of my career, even in England and Scotland. I didn't think I'd be good enough to play abroad.
Right, okay.
So, like, I'd always felt that... I'd always thought... I'd never been of the mind that English goalkeepers were always the best. I never thought that.
Right.
So even when I was younger, when you had the likes of Shilton and Neville Southall, who were among the best at the time...
Yes.
Especially... to me, Neville Southall was, at the time, was the best there was.
He was incredible, like late 80s.
Yeah, and sort of mid-late 80s, and he became a bit of a hero. And you know, reading books about him, he had one book on goalkeeping where it was, I kind of got my ethos from that about hard work. You know, he kept repeating over and over that you have to work hard, and I used to watch him go for a warm-up. It's like, yeah, an hour and a half before the game, he'd start a warm-up, like, you know.
Yeah.
And went from one extreme to another. I remember reading about some days he'd just go and have a bath to warm up before a game. Other days he'd be there like an hour and a half, you know, taking other goalkeepers out with him when it wasn't a done thing. You know, when it, you know, somebody went out and kicked a few balls at you, and that was you warmed up. But so around that time, I didn't really think that British goalkeepers were actually the best the way that we thought that they were.
So who were your gold standard of goalkeepers then, if you had to name a nation when you were a kid developing?
Yeah, Germany. Yeah, and always have been, really, because that my father talked about Sepp Maier. Obviously, it was before my time.
Okay.
Know? And then and I used to read up a lot about goalkeepers, obviously about Lev Yashin, and then in the mid 80s, then go back to the World Cup, the likes of Joel Batts and people like that, and it was, I don't know, it wasn't just the style of football, particularly the style of football that that foreign teams played, but I never got that. This thing about foreign goalkeepers or continental goalkeepers being
flappy.
Or being like extravagant, and
yeah.
It just seemed to me that they may be more athletic and more like a gymnast than a goalkeeper. To me, English goalkeepers, I mean, I'm probably really generalising here, but from back then, my memory of goalkeepers would be really sort of, I want to say a wooden, but I've probably been really disrespectful. But it was just like that. All these foreign goalkeepers seem like gymnasts, and so sort of there seemed to be a lot more to them.
Yeah,
more like another dimension to them than British goalkeepers.
I remember when I lived in Lyon about must be about 10 years ago now. I had a mate over from Newcastle, actually, and we wandered into the stadium, the old stadium, the Gerland, one day, because they'd just not locked it, and he wanted to have a bit of a look, even though it was a non-match day. And the Lyon staff were playing the women's team. And obviously, they've got a really good women's team, but the staff, they had Sonny Anderson playing up front. Joel Batts was in goal. He could still play. He could still play. And he's like
still
50.
Have the hair, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's very, very curly, just a lot grayer. So for you, hearing you talk so passionately about goalkeepers and what goalkeepers you like, you always wanted to be a goalkeeper or like you were never an outfielder?
No, never. It was just because my dad was my dad started off as a central defender when he was younger.
Okay.
Broke his leg and then became a goalkeeper, then became like a good sort of semi-pro goalkeeper.
Okay.
And then, so that's all I remember was that going to watch him play as a kid, being taken along, sitting, it used to be a place called Tunstall Hill in Sunderland. And it's like the highest point in Sunderland. It's like up there in the middle of summer, it's still snowing and windy and rain, you know. So I just go up there with my father, watch him play, and that's all I ever wanted to do.
Yeah,
was be a goalkeeper or just be like him.
Yeah,
and then so that was it. And it's not like I didn't even think about it. So there was no choice to be made. I just was going to be a goalkeeper. That was it. And I would never say that. Yeah, I could have been an outfield player. Could have been really good, but. Oh, I don't think I would have been.
So, I guess then Sunderland is the closest objective, and you ended up there at Sunderland. I mean, that must have been a big thing for your mates and stuff when you signed as a pro there.
Yeah, huge. But for me, it was the only place I wanted to sign.
Hmm.
Back then, you couldn't sign for a club until you were 13. But I enjoyed going to different clubs so much that I didn't sign for Sunderland until I really had to.
Right.
So then I could reel off all the clubs I would go to regularly. Like I'd go to Manchester United, I'd go to their School of Excellence on a Wednesday night, the other School of Excellence in the North East.
So what, it's kind of like they're all courting you?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And right. I just loved going. So, like, 6 weeks' holidays would be spent at a week at every club.
Oh, wow.
So, going to Villa or Ipswich, Middlesbrough.
That's amazing. I could see why you would love that.
Yeah. It was brilliant. And it was like, but I made a conscious decision that, with my dad, that we weren't going to sign for anybody and we would wait the last possible moment so we'd have the best choice. So then I'd. Whoever I signed for, then that was, you know, I'd had a lot of thought put into it. But then all I was doing was waiting for someone to ask me to sign for it.
So you said that you wanted to kind of mould yourself in the image of your dad. How important was he when it came to the age of making choices and stuff in helping you to make your decisions?
When it came to that point, he was pivotal, really. But in a way that we'd got to a point in our relationship where he allowed me to make my own decisions.
Mm.
So from being, you know, in school teams when I was like 8, 9 years old, I'd always play for teams that were older than me. So for the first couple of years when I was playing, I never played with my friends. I always played with the year above or 2 years above.
Okay.
Yeah, so, and it wasn't, I found that less enjoyable. And then when my father was on the sidelines, I know that he was only trying to help me, but at the same time, it was a bit overbearing and I was concentrating on more what he was saying to me than I was on the games.
Yes.
So then that sort of snowballed till I was about 13, where we had a big argument and about him talking to me while I was playing and trying to coach me while I was on the pitch, to the point where he said, okay, then I won't then. And then from then on, our relationship was a lot better in that respect because it just allowed me to get on with my football. And then so then, even though...
You're lucky. My dad always used to do that to me when I was driving.
Yeah, I can see now as a... I mean, I don't have a son. I have a daughter, but I think I would be exactly the same way. I wouldn't be able to help myself. And so in some ways, I'd prefer not to have a son so I wouldn't be as overbearing as perhaps my father was. So, but then when it come to making decisions and me being old enough to make my decisions, he was fully behind it, you know, because I think it was, he just wanted what was best for me.
And then it came the day where you decided you had to leave Sunderland if you were going to get games and stuff.
Yeah.
How did that work, and was it a really difficult decision to make? Or was it made quite easy?
No, it was made it was made a lot simpler for me, really, by the fact that I sat down with Peter Reid in his office, and you know, he'd been in with a player earlier, just before me, and then he, you know, I went in the office and he says, you know, he was complaining about his player because the attitude wasn't very good, you know, and and then he moved on to me and he was saying, look, attitude's great, you work really hard, but yeah, if you're here next season, you're going to be in the same position. I'd spent the best part of the last two seasons injured. Prior to that, Peter Reid had sort of sat me down and said, you're going to be my number two. I'm going to bring Brad Friedel in. We're going to sign Brad Friedel, and you're going to be my number two.
Oh, wow.
And then, and at the time, I was probably about 19 at the time. And so then I was on the bench a lot. And it was really, that was like, I think, right, well, that's it. I've done a lot of hard work. I'm getting to where I want to be now. And then it's only a matter of time before I get in the first team, and they give me a game in the League Cup. And unfortunately, before games, I was supposed to make my debut against Leicester. Broke my arm twice.
Right.
In the week before both games. So that when it was, and then Shea Given came. We had to bring Shea Given. Well, we didn't have to, but we brought Shea Given on loan.
Yeah.
So I'm out, I think it was about 4 months with a broken arm that wouldn't heal. Oh. And then, standing on the sidelines watching Shea, Shea Given's career just sort of started flourishing on it. It was frustrating. It's frustrating, but it's
if I'd have known how good he would turn out to be for Newcastle, they wouldn't have done that.
No, exactly. Yeah, but no, I mean, Shea, you could, from the moment Shea came in, you could see how impressive he was. You know, I think he'd spent a couple of months on loan at Swindon. You know,
because he still belonged to Blackburn then.
Yeah, right? It was Blackburn. Yeah, yeah. I think. Steve McMahon was manager of Swindon.
Right.
Obviously, Peter Reid had been on the front room, close friends.
Sure.
And you would see, from the moment he came in, you could see he was just a level above, like, you know. There was no doubt he was going to be the keeper he turned out to be, you know. And again, another hard, really down to earth, really hard working, but a brilliant goalkeeper. So it was frustrating that I didn't actually get my chance there, but. Like Peter Reid said, it's a cash 22. You'll be here next year and still be in the same position. And you need to go and get games. And then eventually, it turned out that was probably the best thing that I ever did, was to go to Darlington.
And eventually, you end up at Aberdeen, sort of rotating almost with another real legend of the game in Jim Leighton. I mean, you've played with some top goalkeepers. What did playing with Leighton do for you?
Again, I mean, there's a theme going through this that he was an incredibly hard-working goalkeeper.
I mean, because he'd been there and come back, really, hadn't he, by that point? Because he'd been through that spell. I mean, he'd been part of that great Aberdeen team with Sir Alex. It started quite well at Manchester United, and then it went quite badly wrong, and then he ended up back where it all started. I mean, for a goalkeeper... like, how do you move on from those moments? Because, like, all players have moments of greater form and worse form, unless you're Ronaldo or Messi. But when you go through those moments of bad form as a goalkeeper, it's almost like a public shaming, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
So how did he deal with that, and how do goalkeepers in general deal with that?
I think it's because... I've always seen goalkeeping, I've said this before, I've always seen goalkeeping as a, it's more of a battle with yourself than it is against strikers and the opposition.
Okay.
And if you win that battle with yourself, then you'll go on to become a good goalkeeper. I'm not sure I ever did that. Hmm. There was periods when I did, but...
What, not consistently, you mean?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So it was... When people talk about goalkeepers and have mental strength, that's what it is. You're not actually overcoming whatever's happened to you or certain situations, because if you've been a goalkeeper from an early age, you get used to overcoming these little bumps all the time. And then I think as an outfield player, a midfielder can give the ball away, he gets a chance seconds later to win the ball back, or within 60 seconds to make a pass to correct that.
Whereas you're stood there thinking about it if you've made a mistake that well, if 9 times out of 10, if you make a mistake, it leads to a goal.
Yeah.
As a goalkeeper. I mean, it's funny when you watch football on television. Like, if a goalkeeper makes a mistake, it's almost sadistic, isn't it? Like how the director like focuses on them, like they want to get that shot of them, like, you know, holding the glove to their face or, you know, looking up to the sky or whatever, don't they?
Yeah, and I think if there's one thing that I wish that I did differently as a player was probably not to show those emotions, because I was a really emotional person.
Right.
I could never hide it, and I loved. I suppose a bit of a, I don't know. Is it just juxtaposition? Or maybe it's just the wrong word. I don't know. It's not very good for somebody who's been a bit of a writer. But it's kind of like I love the emotion of it all. I loved as much as I hated the lows. I loved them as well, because
yeah.
And that's what I missed in the few years where I trying to get everything in check, trying to get everything on a balance and try and take the emotion out of it and be more methodical in the way that I did things. And I didn't enjoy football at all. But I probably had the two or three best seasons of my career.
Right.
But I just didn't enjoy it.
Well, because it's more like a job.
Yeah, it was just a process.
Mm.
It became just a process. And that's what you miss when you stop playing. It's, you don't just miss the highs, you miss the lows as well. You miss that feeling of, even though it's a low feeling and a feeling of sort of distress, it's also a feeling of fighting back. That feeling of, right, I'm going to do better next time, and I can't play badly the next time. I've got to do better next time. And so
it's a
cyclical process, you know, and it's And that's what you miss. You miss that motivation, because sometimes I think when you stop playing, you don't have that reason to rise again.
Yeah.
And I think that the setbacks can have a bigger effect on you. So like with goalkeeping, it is about mentally overcoming these setbacks, and you do get used to it. And Jim. You know, Jim suffered a really bad setback with the carry-on that happened with the blame for the goals in the cup final, the cup final against Crystal Palace. And he was sent away. I think he went to Arsenal, Reading, Sheffield United on loan.
All over the shop, yeah.
Yeah, and rebuilt his career. And it took him 8 years, really. If you track it from that FA Cup final to France 98, that was his redemption, getting back into the World Cup squad and playing in his fourth World Cup, and that's what that's all goalkeeping was ever about, or eventually became for me, was the hard work and the mental battles about overcoming all these setbacks. And now there's an argument to say that if you were a good goalkeeper, you've got less setbacks to overcome.
Mm.
You know, so there's probably. Yeah, if you're not the best or one of the best, then you've got more to overcome than others, you know.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
If we skip on to your media career, did broadcasting and writing change the way you viewed the game and change the way you viewed goalkeeping at all? Like stepping out of it for the first time in 20 years?
Yeah.
Because it's funny. I think fans and people who listen to this show and writers, sometimes we can assume that players are just like us, the fans just like us, that they'll watch as much football as us. That's not always the case. If I was a player, I wouldn't want to watch football on my time off. I mean, what was it like for you? Were you one of those players who watched a lot of football in your time off? And how did your relationship with watching football change once you started writing and broadcasting for a living?
Nothing changed in the sense that I watch football constantly.
Right.
So, and it's not like now where you've got Y Scout, like you can go and watch everything that's, you know, in preparation for games, you can watch your clips, you can watch, you know, preparation for opposition. Mm. It wasn't readily available. It used to be really hard to get sort of DVDs and footage of even of my own games when I played, just to study them and see what I could have done better. And I wish, my career would have been now if I was born a little bit later. Mm. The fact that you could do all of this analysis because
you're hungry for that and it wasn't necessarily available.
Yeah, exactly. So then a lot of the time if you're seeing footage of yourself on TV, it's most of the time it's because you've conceded a goal. Mm. You know, if it's just the goals that are on TV, that can have a negative effect on you because, like I said, you're watching yourself concede goals, but also that I wanted to get better all the time, and I was sort of the detail I was going to. I'd be constantly changing my game because I thought, well, this will make me better. If I do this, it'll make me better. And
is that a regret?
Yes, a little bit. But I also think that if the resources were available to look back at train, like I said now, as we were talking before, we can watch every training session back from multiple angles now. And we can go into great detail about, you know, with every player. If we could have been able to do that, then it would have stopped a lot of doubts in my mind. Like I said, we talked about the mental battles before. What you see through your eyes isn't actually always what
the rest of the world actually happens.
And so it just gives yourself a change of perception. And one thing, once I started analysing my games, when that became available and I was playing first team football, especially when I was Aberdeen, you get DVDs, I was always amazed how little you were involved as a goalkeeper.
Mm.
because in the game you feel part of the game, you're actually right in the middle of it, and you're connected to everything.
Because you're always ready.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And for me it was important to be to always stay focused, and by constantly talking to the people in front of me, and you keep yourself involved in the game. But actually the touches of the ball, it's not you irrelevant, but it was, you know, you don't have a great influence on most games.
Yeah.
And I think that, but yeah, going back to the same about the analysis, it never changed. And probably since I stopped playing, it got worse, because I can't watch a game on TV. You know, people who follow me on Twitter will realise that I'm only getting out what I'm thinking. And it's a bit of therapy, really.
It's Twitter, like, cathartic.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And that's how, and that's why I got, I mean, my missus in there, she'd probably say that I'm still addicted to it a little bit, but it was a real sort of therapy, that everything that was bouncing around my head, and instead of shouting at the TV, I'm shouting at everybody else who's following me.
Yeah.
And of course, that's, it wasn't a bad thing, because then it kind of got me noticed in the media. But for the media, I didn't just do it just to be noticed. The media stuff was all something that I'd always wanted to do.
Okay.
Always wanted to do.
Well, I think, like, people who read your columns and hear your punditry will know you're very thoughtful anyway. But I don't think it's unfair to say you specifically made a name of yourself, but for yourself, by your analysis of goalkeeping. Some might say that's pretty natural as a goalkeeper, but to me, you're like a goalkeeping Gary Neville. Like, when he came into punditry, people were like, whoa, where's this come from? Because the level of nuance, the level of detail was so great. I mean, for me, I'm someone who watches a lot of football. I think I know a reasonable amount about it. But to me, and I think to a lot of people, goalkeeping's still a bit of a mystery. Mm. I think I could say broadly what makes a good goalkeeper and a bad goalkeeper. I think not just good saves make a good goalkeeper. I think there's more to it than that. I think, you know, you need a different type of goalkeeper for teams with different aims and all that sort of thing. Some areas it's more about concentration. Some, if you're down at the bottom, it will be about making saves and all that sort of stuff. But you've brought this different layer of to goalkeeping analysis, and you know, when you talk about how someone's set when they're facing a free kick, their footwork, all that sort of stuff. Why, in this age when we have so many statistics in football, more than ever before, and not just guys like you who work in the game, but punters, yeah, you know, people who watch the game, I think we've got an incredibly learned public now, more than ever, because people have so much football that they can watch and they have so many statistics to hand. Why do we know so little about goalkeeping still, about the detail of it?
Well, I think a lot of it is that people don't want to know, because they weren't particularly bothered. You know, it was, I think people...
Why? Because goalkeeper's a convenient scapegoat for your team?
Yeah, because I think in the past, when people thought about goalkeepers, it's either a case of he saved it, or well done, he didn't save it, that was bad.
Right.
And it's really sort of oversimplified it. Having said that, you know, the level of detail that goes into across the board and out to different positions on the pitch, they could, you know... It could still be specialised sort of punditry in different positions as well. Like, you know, I know it can be easy if you get like one defender, one striker, you know, but very rarely is there a goalkeeper brought on to you and used particularly for that position, or to analyse that position.
It's really rare, isn't it? When it's such a key position in the pitch, and as you were saying before, it's such a solitary position.
Yeah, exactly. And it takes a lot more. It's a lot more nuanced, and it takes a lot more understanding to analyse the position, because it's like many people have we've seen before, that outfield players don't analyse goalkeepers well, because they're not seeing it through from a goalkeeper's eyes. They're
right.
Not seeing it from that position. And this, they're either seeing it from where they stood on the pitch, or they're seeing it from the bench, you know. And the only true point of view that matters is two eyes in between the posts, because it's a viewpoint that nobody else on the pitch has got.
Mm.
And
And actually, you can see everything.
From exactly. Yeah, and that's why I've always thought that goalkeepers should make we're natural analysts simply because, one, we've got the best viewpoint.
Yeah.
And two, we've got time to actually think about the game in game. Players, it's sometimes a centre midfield player, if it's a hectic game, they play an instinct, you know, more so than a goalkeeper. Well, a goalkeeper's got, he can think a lot about the game. We can think tactically. Yeah. We can control the game tactically through coaching the defenders and the team in front of us.
Yeah.
And become a much more pivotal player on the pitch because of the influence they can have in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing, isn't it? People have always railed against goalkeeper captains, for example, because people want a chest-beating centre-half, or people want a midfielder who makes loads of tackles, or people want a striker who leads from the front. But actually, as you say, because you can actually see what's going on, it makes really good sense, doesn't it?
It does, but also I agree with the... I mean, I've been captain a couple of times for clubs I've been at, at Silverbourne and at Aberdeen. And yeah, I loved it. You know, I probably at times took on the responsibility too much and took on the burden that, you know, if things don't go right, then you take it hits you a little bit harder. But at the same time, I can see why some managers don't give the captaincy to goalkeepers, simply because that's a goalkeeper's job. A goalkeeper's job is to instruct and coach from the back and to be vocal.
So it's like he's not a captain because he's a captain anyway.
So if we can use that, you know, if it's a quiet side, that armband might bring that out of the leadership out of somebody else further forward and be more influential further up the pitch. Okay. Whereas a goalkeeper can't really influence defensively and in his own half, but maybe he can't have that influence further up the pitch. So, I don't see a problem with goalkeepers.
Would you say, though, generally keepers are still a bit undervalued? I mean, you know, you look at the transfer record for Buffon, which stood for nearly 20 years, which is absolutely amazing, the world record transfer for a goalkeeper, until it was broken by Alisson and Kepa, and especially with Alisson.
Yeah.
Seeing the difference he's made to Liverpool, there's no one's arguing about that fee now. But still, there's the feeling that... the Kepa situation was different and to do with how Athletic Bilbao do things. But do you think there's still a bit of a reticence to acknowledge just how important goalkeepers are? Because it's a position that could make or break your season. You know, without a great goalkeeper, you're not winning trophies.
No.
That is the long and the short of it. Do you think there is a kind of lack of respect even in the industry over what a great goalkeeper's worth?
Yeah, well, things are changing, of course, with the fees that are being paid are coming more in line with outfield players. But you look at someone like David De Gea at Manchester United, people are talking whether should they give him £300,000 a week. Well, he's been the most important player at that club for the last 6-7 years, maybe longer, and why wouldn't they give him that money? Why wouldn't they put him in line with the strikers? The likes of Alexis Sanchez, why didn't put him in line with them? It just seems a no-brainer. They shouldn't be asked that question just because he's a goalkeeper. But things are changing because tactically and down to philosophy, goalkeepers are a big part of that now. Östersund's here, Ali Keita and Sixto Molin, and Andrew Mills, another Englishman. Three goalkeepers here who wouldn't be here if they weren't exceptional with their feet. And especially in the case of Ali Keita, he's so influential in the way that we play here that it's everything starts with him. So that if he's not there, then it has a knock-on effect all the way up the pitch. And I think it's when it comes to he's out of contract at the end of the season, and in my eyes, it's imperative that we keep hold of him because, like I said, goalkeepers like him are very difficult to find.
Yeah,
and I think that's where I'd certainly be saying to the person who holds the purse strings here that, don't worry about thinking, can we give this to a goalkeeper? Then you think, can we give this amount of money to one of the most influential players on the pitch? So it's to me, positionally, it's irrelevant. You look at fullbacks now. Fullbacks were often, just above goalkeepers in the pecking order. Now they're possibly some of them in some teams the most important players in the pitch. So it depends on the philosophy and the side they're in.
So you talked about working with the goalkeepers here at Ostersunds. I mean, how does it work, the dynamic with being a goalkeeper coach? I mean, obviously it's your specialty. It's been your specialty for over 20 years. But, I mean, it's a big responsibility, isn't it? Working with them as a small team, and it is a very small team. So you're slightly away from the group, and also, how do they support each other? I mean, you must know that as a player as well. Like, how does it work to have that sort of support network, but knowing at the end of it there can only be one?
Yeah, it's vitally important that everyone, in my eyes, everyone's closer. In my career, probably just came across one or two goalkeepers who were had a less of a team ethic when it comes to goalkeeping. You know,
right.
Very okay. People can be single-minded and selfish, but I think in the small department that we have together, that it's important that everyone supports each other fully. So, like today is a prime example that Sixto Moline, 22 years old, very good young goalkeeper, came into the sides before the mid-season break when Ali was injured. Did really well to start with, and then maybe not so well for a couple of games. Came back out when Ali came back in fit. Mm. Ali went away to the African Nations for two games. Sixtons came in, did really well. Ali's back from the African Nations now, and he's out. Now there was no throwing the toys. Of course, he's disappointed not to be playing, but there's no throwing the toys out the pram.
Is that an age thing partly though? Because I mean, you know, we see that again in Italy, for example. You know, you get a goalkeeper that is brought in and does really well when he's 20, 21, and then might have to sit out and suck it up on the bench for a couple of years. You know, you really have to earn trust, and you know, people feel that you almost have to have a few miles on the clock to be able to be relied upon.
Yeah, there is that, but also it's having like your own small department, personal relationships are going to be closer than maybe the couple of coaches in there with the rest of the squad. Of course, everyone tries to build bonds and relationships, but I think it's more personal with goalkeepers, and because of, like we've talked about, the mental battles that you can have as a goalkeeper and the setbacks you can have, it's important that you do have that support. And I spend a lot of time that's not just with you know, out on the pitch with them, but having chats, after things have happened in games, if they have setbacks, or especially if things have gone well as well.
And are you more of a psychological coach than other parts of the coaching staff, maybe? Because that's such a huge part of the role.
Yeah, I'd say so, and it's more about a goalkeeping coach now, it's not about going having 40 minutes before they go and join with the rest of the squad. It's not about just, and then, you know, doing some technical work with them. As the years have gone on, and goalkeeping has sort of evolved, you spend less and less time doing that, the traditional goalkeeper work. If you go on a goalkeeping course now, it's far more about tactical work, how to integrate goalkeepers into systems and how they would fit into different teams.
What you were talking about, the goalkeeper being like the first playmaker.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And less about the technique side of it.
Yeah.
And now it's fully integrated, you know, so now I probably spend less time with them, with myself, and more with the rest of the squad, and working with them while they're inside a bigger umbrella of what the squad is doing tactically.
I mean, does that sort of help, really, being part of it all, not just because it is very much a team sport, but also because, you know, it always struck me that goalkeeping training is quite repetitive.
Mm.
When I watch a lot of goalkeepers train, and you know, I've seen you try to mix it up, getting the tennis racket and the balls out, and you know, I understand there's a science behind that, but making it fun and making it engaging, I mean, in any level of teaching, whether you're teaching school kids or whether you're a coach, that's really important, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's moved on massively and changed massively in the last 10 years when it comes down to sports science as well. Mm. You're not doing sets of 12 where you're diving up and down, up and down, up and down. So you're physically exhausted at the end of it because it doesn't happen in the game. So why do it in training?
Yeah.
But of course, you have to train at the higher intensity and higher level of games, so the game becomes easier. But the philosophies are totally changing. Now it's about, well, if you don't do it in a game, why would you do it in training?
Yeah.
It's a more functional training and creating situations that happen in games rather than... Yeah, of course, repetitive stuff and technical stuff, when you're correcting technique... It has a purpose, but once you get to the level we're at and first team level, it's more about how they fit into the team in games, dealing with game type situations, and more often than not, goalkeeping is less about hands and feet and more about decisions.
Yeah,
and you make the right decisions more often than not than the technique and physical side of it means less.
Can you see yourself being a head coach eventually?
Do you know what? When I was still playing, I had a very fixed mind on how I would approach if I was going to be a coach. And I thought, yeah, that's definitely for me. And as I came out of playing and started coaching, I thought, well, you know, maybe it wasn't for me. I would never say never, but I think that for me, it's... specialising in what I do now and being able to go into as much detail as I do now. I think
you'd have to spread yourself too thinly as a head coach.
Yeah, and I think that's why I admire people like Bielsa, people who other people think are crazy because it overtakes their lives.
Yeah.
Because they have to make sure that if they go into as much detail as they want to, they have to spend every waking hour working on it, thinking about it. And it's not that I don't do that with goalkeeping, but it just means that it allows me to go into so much more detail, and I'm happy with that because it's more than enough for me. And the funny thing about it is that I came out of full-time coaching a couple of years ago to work in the media and for family reasons. My daughter was up in Newcastle, so I needed time to see her, so then it was... obviously working weekends with football, and it wasn't working for me, so I took a bit of time away, and it took so much of time adjusting from playing to civilian life to getting back to some kind of normality, and then I've thrown myself back into it again, and here I am obsessing about free kicks, corners, and do you know what I mean? It's, I don't know whether I am crazy for doing it, you know, but it's, I know that I'm having a hell of a time doing it. And when you're right in the middle of football the way I am now, you wonder why you would ever want to be outside of it.
This was a Radio Staccato production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year. just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Listen to this Acast show ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.